Right now, I mean, if you really stop to think about it, modern humans celebrate the gift of a new year of life with like sugar crashes, extreme hangovers, sleep deprivation, and credit card debt.
Yeah, it's a pretty wild paradox when you put it like that.
It really is. And yet, ironically, we put more genuine joy, deep reflection, and, narrative connection into how we celebrate death than how we celebrate life.
It's a profound contradiction. I mean,
Yeah.
we architect these incredibly meaningful, community-rich events for the departed, but for our on-living milestones, we just default to this script of mindless consumption.
Right. And we are going to completely deconstruct that script today.
Well,
Welcome to the Deep Dive. We're exploring a really fascinating blog article titled Your Birthday Celebrations.
written by Puru.
Yes, exactly. Puru, also known as Puru the Guru. And we're looking at his article alongside a huge stack of historical, cultural, and religious research that traces the ideas and the hyperlinks in his piece.
Which is great,
Yeah.
because the goal here is to offer you, the listener, a practical alternative to really transform personal milestones from these engines of commercial indulgence into genuine checkpoints for growth.
Exactly. But I mean, to even begin rethinking how we celebrate, we have to recognize that the modern birthday format is not like a biological default.
Oh, not at all. It feels innate. Because, well, we all grew up with it. But it is a highly constructed, actually relatively recent cultural invention.
That's something I've often wondered about, looking at pets or wildlife. Like a dog obviously has no concept of turning three.
Right.
They experience joy, they play, but the actual anniversary of their birth means absolutely nothing to them.
Because in the animal kingdom, there's just no biological drive to track the anniversary of birth. Animals live in a continuous present.
You're just vibing.
Exactly. To celebrate a birthday, you need an episodic memory structured around solar cycles. You need a calendrical system, and this is key. You need a cultural mechanism to transmit that tradition.
So it's like a massive feat of cognitive abstraction that's uniquely human.
Totally.
So, okay, if it's not an instinct, and most of our ancient ancestors lived their entire lives without ever acknowledging the day they were born, how did we get here?
Right, to the point where a birthday makes one individual the temporary center of the universe.
Yeah, how did that happen?
Well, originally it was all about power and divinity. For centuries, tracking and celebrating a birth date was a practice reserved strictly for gods, pharaohs, and elite rulers.
Wow, so everyday people just didn't do it.
No, not at all. In ancient Egypt, the celebration wasn't even about biological birth. It was the day a pharaoh was crowned, marking their quote-unquote divine birth as a god.
Oh, that makes sense. It was a status symbol.
Huge status symbol.
Yeah.
And when the practice eventually trickled down in ancient Rome, it was heavily restricted. Like only free Roman men were allowed to have their birthday celebrated.
Wait, really? What about women?
Women were systematically excluded from this practice for centuries.
Man, of course they were. Because giving someone a birthday celebration inherently grants them like a degree of individual importance and status.
Precisely. And looking across different regions, you really see how much cultural values dictated this stuff.
Oh.
Like ancient Persia threw massive, splendid festivals for birthdays.
I can picture that. Lots of feasting.
Oh, yeah. They viewed it as the most important day of the year, hosting banquets that could last for days. But in stark contrast, ancient China actively resisted the practice for centuries.
Oh, that's super interesting. That points directly to the difference between individualistic and collective societies.
Yeah. Exactly. Traditional Confucian values place the emphasis heavily on the community, the family unit, and the elders.
So highlighting one individual's specific birthday would probably seem, what, arrogant or disruptive to the social fabric?
That is the exact mechanism at play. It was seen as elevating the self over the collective.
So when did they start celebrating them?
Well, when traditional Chinese culture finally did begin adopting birthday customs around the 6th century CE, they didn't adopt the Persian model of, individual glory.
How did they do it then?
They framed it through the lens of Buddhist filial piety. The celebration was functionally a day to honor the parents for the hardship they endured to bring you into the world.
Oh, wow. Which is a beautiful inversion of how we do it now. We demand presents, and they're like, thank you, mom, for the pain.
Exactly. It was about gratitude, not entitlement.
But if we fast forward, it seems pretty clear that the shift from that kind of solemn reflection to the hyper celebration we see today, that was driven by industrialization,
Oh,
right?
absolutely. The modern birthday is, at its core, a byproduct of mass production.
Because of the cake? The historical rarity of cake and sugar makes that so obvious.
Right. Before the Industrial Revolution, refined sugar and fine flour were luxury commodities. Elaborate cakes were strictly for the aristocracy.
So when did the modern birthday cake actually start?
The Western-style birthday cake actually has its roots in 15th century Germany during a celebration called Kinderfest. But it was very localized.
Just a local tradition.
Yeah. But once industrialization made those ingredients cheap and accessible, commercial interests realized they could scale the tradition globally.
It's crazy to think about.
It is. In fact, in parts of Asia, the Western-style birthday cake has only become a common cultural practice within the last 50 years.
That's wild. And the commercialization obviously didn't stop at cheap flour. I mean, we are now dealing with a $19.6 billion greeting card industry.
Staggering amount of money.
And an $11.4 billion party industry. These industries haven't just monetized the birthday. They've, like, architected a mandatory social obligation.
Yes, they absolutely have.
If you don't buy the card, buy the cake, and throw the party, you're perceived as a bad friend or a bad parent. They've essentially monetized our fear of social exclusion.
Which pushes us toward what Piru's article describes as the harmful end of the spectrum.
Yeah, let's talk about that, because Piru makes some strong points here.
He does. He points out a pretty dark reality. By blindly following this commercial script, we are literally volunteering to become customers of the sick care industry.
The data backing that up in the research is, well, it's sobering.
It really is. When you look at hospitalizations around legal drinking age birthdays.
Like turning 21 here in the U.S.
Right. The numbers spike by 114% for men.
Oh, my God.
And 164% for women.
That is just insane. We are using the anniversary of our birth as a socially sanctioned excuse to poison ourselves to the point of requiring emergency medical intervention.
Yeah. The culture provides this temporary hall pass for self-destruction.
It's like we've completely confused celebration with consumption.
Exactly. The prefrontal cortex, which handles our risk assessment, is essentially overridden by this cultural mandate that you have to go hard to properly celebrate.
It's a funnel.
It's totally a funnel. The hospitality and alcohol industries sell the indulgence, and the medical system is left to manage the fallout.
So if the default commercial script is funneling people into hospitals and debt, we clearly need a new approach.
Right.
Because humans do need milestones, right? We need ways to mark the passage of time.
We do. We are narrative creatures.
So how do we fulfill that psychological need without the toxic consumption? And this brings us to Piru's alternative, which he calls the two-realm framework.
Yes. Piru argues that a genuine celebration of life needs to operate in two interconnected spaces, the mental health realm and the physical health realm.
Okay, let's break those down. What is the mental health realm?
In the mental health realm, the focus is on a backward-looking introspection. It's about setting an intention through reflection and gratitude.
Okay, that sounds nice.
But crucially, he emphasizes finding meaning in the negative events that shaped your journey, not just the positive ones. It's an audit of how challenges built your resilience.
Okay, I have to push back here for a second.
Go for it.
I hear phrases like backward-looking introspection and auditing negative events, and honestly, that sounds like a lot of work.
It does sound heavy.
Right. Because for most people, a birthday is supposedly the one day a year they get a free pass to turn their brain off, not like conduct a spiritual audit. Is Piru suggesting that we're never allowed to just have mindless fun?
It's a super common reaction, and Piru actually anticipates it. He addresses it with a very stark philosophical stance in his piece. He states, quote, "The refusal to think is evil."
Whoa, that is an intense way to phrase it. Evil.
It sounds severe, yeah. But he's not using evil in a cartoonish villain sense. He's pointing to the ethical obligation we have to our future selves and our communities.
Right, because mindless action has consequences.
Exactly. Mindless action, the refusal to examine why we are consuming what we consume, is what leads to chronic illness, environmental degradation, and superficial relationships.
It's not about being a buzzkill.
No, not at all. It's about recognizing that when we prioritize superficial indulgence over genuine health, we aren't celebrating life at all.
We're just executing a commercial transaction.
Yes.
Yeah.
Perfect way to put it. And this concept actually mirrors the ancient religious wisdom found in the supporting research.
Right. The sources dug into that quite a bit.
Yeah, like the Buddhist emphasis on recognizing the preciousness of a human birth. the Jewish traditions of spending birthdays in deep spiritual reflection and study.
And the Hindu practices of meditating and offering anonymous charity on your birthday.
Exactly. These traditions treat the milestone as a sacred checkpoint, not a consumer event.
Which brings us to the physical health realm of his framework. How does one physiologically align with that mental state?
By choosing activities that compound your health rather than deplete it.
So, practically speaking, what does Puru suggest?
He suggests engaging in nature-based activities, aligning your day with cosmic time by, say, intentionally watching the sunrise or sunset.
I love that idea.
Right. Nourishing the body with plant-based foods and finding joy without the numbing effect of alcohol. You align your physical actions to respect the biological machinery that keeps you alive.
Okay, I get it in theory, but how does a person actually implement this without becoming a complete social pariah?
What do you mean?
Like, if I decide to skip my best friend's birthday dinner because they're serving steak and tequila, and I tell them, sorry, I'm at home auditing my resilience, I am going to lose my friends.
Yeah, you probably would.
We still have to exist within a society that runs on the old script.
And Carew understands that. He offers a very practical middle path for this, which he calls the flexibility principle, or pragmatic grace.
Pragmatic grace. I like that. What does that look like?
He advocates for intentional participation. You do not have to be rigid or isolate yourself. You attend your friend's traditional imperfect party.
Okay, so you still go?
You still go. But you choose the healthiest options available. You cheerfully decline the alcohol. You engage in deep, meaningful conversation rather than superficial small talk.
And then you leave at a reasonable hour.
Exactly. You leave at a reasonable hour to protect your circadian rhythm and your sleep.
Even with that grace, though, there's going to be friction. I mean, anyone who has ever tried to politely turn down a shot of liquor or a massive slice of cake at a party knows that people get weirdly defensive.
Oh, incredibly defensive.
Even if you don't say a single word of judgment, your mere refusal seems to offend them. Why is that?
The psychological mechanism behind that defensiveness is known as the mirror effect, and it's fueled by cognitive dissonance.
The mirror effect.
Yeah. When you make a mindful, disciplined choice in the middle of a socially sanctioned binge, your behavior acts as a mirror. It removes the social camouflage from their own mindless consumption.
So they aren't actually angry at you.
Nope. They're uncomfortable with the reflection of their own habits. They want your birthday, or their birthday, to serve as an unquestioned excuse for indulgence.
And if you remove the excuse, they are forced to look at their own relationship with alcohol or sugar.
That is exactly the dynamic. They will often employ social pressure, saying things like, come on, you ought to enjoy life for once.
Right. I've heard that exact phrase so many times.
We all have. But that argument falsely equates joy with consumption. Puru's philosophy reframes this beautifully. The response isn't about deprivation. It's recognizing that you are enjoying life.
You're fully present rather than numbing yourself to it.
Exactly.
Now, this brings up what might be the ultimate stress test for this entire philosophy.
Oh, I know where you're going with this.
Children.
Yep.
It's one thing to navigate adult peer pressure, but the birthday industry's grip on children's parties is absolute.
It is a stranglehold.
The modern format is designed to convince a child that for one day, they are the undisputed center of the universe.
And that format is essentially social programming in miniature.
How so?
Well, think about it. When a developing brain receives unearned, hyper-concentrated attention, massive dopamine spikes from processed sugar, and just an overwhelming influx of material excess.
Just tearing through wrapping paper.
Right. It fundamentally skews their social mapping. It fosters a deep sense of entitlement and actively severs their understanding of being just one part of a larger interconnected community.
Which perfectly explains the inevitable 4 o'clock meltdown at every major kid's party.
Oh, the crying is guaranteed.
It's not just a sugar crash, is it? It's a neurological system overload.
Exactly. The child's baseline for dopamine has been spiked so unnaturally high by the presence and the attention that the drop-off is physically painful for them.
So what does Puru suggest we do about kids' parties?
He advocates for a complete reset of how we celebrate children. Gatherings should be small, focused on unstructured play rather than performative entertainment.
No clowns or rented petting zoos?
Nope. And food should consist of nutrient-dense, healthy treats to maintain stable blood sugar and mood.
The goal is to teach them that they are an integral, loved part of a community, not a deity demanding tribute.
Beautifully said, yes.
But practically speaking, as a parent, how do you handle the peer pressure on the child? If a kid goes to school and hears that their classmate had a $500 bouncy castle and unwrapped 30 plastic toys,
they're going to compare.
Right. Won't they feel cheated if their parent gives them, like, a nature walk and a healthy muffin?
This touches on the absolute core of authentic leadership and parental modeling. Children map their expectations based entirely on what they observe the adults in their lives prioritizing.
Okay, so if a parent throws massive, consumption-heavy blowout parties for their own adult milestones, but then forces a quiet, mindful hike on the child,
the child senses the hypocrisy immediately, and they feel deprived.
Because the parent is using the child to act out a philosophy they haven't actually adopted themselves.
Precisely. The parent must model the behavior first.
That makes total sense.
If the child consistently sees their parents finding genuine, radiant joy in nature, in quiet reflection, and in deep connection during their own adult milestones, the child accepts this as the natural order of things.
They learn what actually matters.
Yes. And they begin to realize that the chaotic, consumption-heavy parties of their peers are often just adult performances.
Oh, parents competing for status with other parents.
Exactly. Rather than true joy for the child.
And the sources note that this philosophy doesn't stop at birthdays. The framework extends universally.
Oh, yeah, it applies to everything.
Like, a high school or college graduation doesn't have to be a massive catered bash. It could be a focused gathering centered on gratitude and reflecting on the difficult lessons learned.
Or a wedding anniversary. It doesn't require purchasing an artificially inflated diamond.
Right. It could be a shared journey in nature, reflecting on the resilience of the partnership. Birthdays just happen to be the most frequent practice ground we have for these values.
It is really about recalling all transitions as meaningful checkpoints.
Which brings us full circle to that paradox we started with at the top of the show. To truly see how distorted our modern celebrations of life have become, we just need to look at how different cultures handle the end of it.
It is the ultimate contrast. When you look globally, cultures celebrate death with profound joy, intentionality, and deep meaning.
Like the Dia de los Muertos in Mexico.
Exactly. Or the construction of fantasy coffins in Ghana, the jazz funerals in New Orleans, and the Fama Diana in Madagascar.
The jazz funeral is such a perfect example of this.
It really is.
After the sorrow of the burial, the brass band switches to upbeat jazz, and the entire community dances through the streets to celebrate the journey of the person's life.
Or in Madagascar, where families periodically bring their ancestors out from the crypts, wrap them in fresh silk, and dance with them to live music while sharing news and stories.
It's beautiful. What is striking about all of these traditions is the shared mechanism.
Right. They all feature vibrant music, storytelling, deep community gathering, and that backward-looking reflection on the resilience and journey of the individual.
Which is exactly what Puru was talking about. They embody the exact mental health realm that Puru advocates for birthdays, but they're doing it for someone who is no longer there to experience it.
It is staggering to realize that we throw more meaningful, reflective, and community-connected events for people who has already passed away than we do for ourselves while we are still here, breathing and capable of growth.
Yeah. And Puru highlights a particularly tragic irony regarding this.
He does. Mm. And it's a gut punch. In our modern subcultures of indulgence, families will sometimes attempt to honor a deceased loved one by consuming the very things that put them in the grave.
Oh, man. Like taking a shot of whiskey to remember an uncle who died of liver failure.
Exactly. Or eating a massive spread of processed junk food to honor someone who suffered a fatal heart attack.
It makes the survivors complicit in the sick care system under the guise of remembrance.
Yes. True remembrance, much like true celebration, should uplift the biological machinery and the spirit. It should be rooted in gratitude for the journey, not in repeating the mindless indulgence that cuts the journey short.
So as we wrap up, what does this actually mean for you as you approach your next milestone? It means recognizing that celebration is not synonymous with spectacle.
And it certainly shouldn't be synonymous with consumption.
Right. By utilizing Puru's two-realm framework, protecting your mental introspection and your physiological health, you can reclaim your milestones from the commercial forces that engineered them.
And the good news is, this transition doesn't require you to change your entire life overnight.
Thank goodness.
Right. Puru often jokes with his readers, though it is also a literal invitation, that he hopes to see them at a summer afternoon garden party in the year 2079.
2079? Why that year?
To celebrate his 110th birthday.
Oh, wow.
Social, productive, sharp, and healthy.
He is playing the ultimate long game.
He really is. And to get to 2079, the actionable advice is simply to introduce one new variable at your next milestone.
Just one thing.
Yeah. Swap a physical manufactured gift for the gift of time, like a walk and talk in nature with a friend. Or commit to waking up early just to observe the sunrise and set an intention.
Test the waters and see how that genuine presence feels compared to the usual cognitive and physical hangover.
Exactly.
I want to leave you with a final thought to mull over. Imagine if we stripped away all the societal obligations. The forced singing, the expensive cakes, the performative presence.
All of it.
What if you treated your birthday purely as an annual performance review of your own character, your resilience, and your spiritual growth?
It's a powerful reframe.
If you removed the artificial reward of mindless indulgence on that one specific day, how might that change the standards and goals you set for yourself the other 364 days of the year?
It forces a total reevaluation of everyday life. I mean, could abandoning the consumer birthday actually push you to build a daily routine, a community, and a physical reality that you do not constantly feel the need to escape from?
If we stop celebrating life by acting like we are desperately trying to numb ourselves to it, maybe we'll finally understand why those cultures dancing in the streets for the departed have it right. We need to bring that deep, vibrant, reflective joy back to the living.
Beautifully said.
Until next time, keep diving deep.